Hello, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's Wednesday, the 13th of May, 2009. I'm your host, Hereward Fenton. And tonight, part two of our Genetic Engineered Foods series, we're going to be talking to Louise Sales, a campaigner from Greenpeace, who is leading the charge against genetically modified foods in Australia. I'll be interviewing her, and in part two of tonight's show, I'll be joined, as always, by Josh Jackson. So this show is a very important show, and it will give you some grounding in the activist perspective on genetically engineered foods, and just reminding our listeners also that there will be a screening of the really excellent film The World According to Monsanto on Saturday the 16th of May. So fasten your seatbelts and get ready for another extremely important broadcast. Well, tonight I have Louise Sales with me. Louise Sales is the genetic engineering campaigner for Greenpeace Australia Pacific in Sydney. And I am just going to read a little from her bio on greenpeace.org. Louise aims to ensure that risky genetically engineered foods are not released into our natural environment and challenges the lax standards currently set by the government food and gene technology regulators. Louise has a long history with Greenpeace, having first joined the organisation as a volunteer almost 20 years ago. She has held a variety of positions in non-governmental organisations around the globe. Louise was the director of Corporate Watch in the UK, where she investigated the practices of biotechnology companies. She has also worked as a campaigner for the Greens in New Zealand and Environment Victoria. Louise has a master's in biodiversity and conservation from the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom and an honours degree in biology. It was during her university studies that she first became aware of the dangers of GE food. Louise is also passionate about animals and has undertaken conservation research on dolphins in Scotland and fish in Bangladesh. So, Louise, welcome to Truth News Radio.
Thank you, Hereward.
It's great to have you aboard. This is our second episode dealing with the topic of GM foods. Last week, we had Bob Phelps, who's a really, really amazing guy and a real expert in so many things. And he gave us a kind of historical overview of the history of genetically genetic modifications going kind of back to, you know, 50 years. And he explained how the technologies had developed and how they'd been harnessed by large corporations. And then he went into quite a detailed analysis of why they don't work in terms of the way we're told that they're meant to work. And then we got into some other questions of the dangers that are associated with them and the I would say, sort of bullying business practices, the corporate bullying that companies like Monsanto are engaged in. And so we kind of covered a lot of ground in that last interview. It went for over an hour. And but what we didn't really get into in a lot of detail is activism in Australia and exactly what people are doing and what they can do, and anyone who's listening to this show, what they can actually do to make a difference. So that's kind of why it'd be great to have you give us some pointers. And also, you're going to be giving a short, you know, introduction to the film on Saturday night, which We Are Change Sydney is showing, which is terrific. I'm really, really pleased to have you for that. So, I'll hand it over to you. And, you know, like, if you can help us to know what it is that we can actually do here and what it is that you're doing, that'd be great.
Yeah, it's great that you've had Bob on the show because he's really one of the leading experts on genetic engineering in Australia. He's been working on the issue nearly as long as the technology's been around itself.
Right.
Greenpeace actually works quite closely with Genethics, Bob's organisation, and a number of other groups in Australia that are working on genetic engineering. So our main focus at the moment is actually on labelling and calling for the proper labelling of GE food, because at the moment the vast majority of GE foods that are out there don't actually have to be labelled. So anything that's highly processed, like canola oil, doesn't actually have to be labelled, and neither do products from animals fed GE feed. So that's what we're calling for at the moment, is we're calling for the federal government to make sure that all genetically engineered foods are labelled as such. So we did some commissioned some polling last year, and 90% of Australian consumers want all GE foods labelled as such. So we think it's the government should give consumers what they want.
I mean, it seems a reasonable expectation. What I know from having watched The World According to Monsanto already is that the reason, the justification they're using in the US is they're saying, well, there is no substantive difference, therefore we don't have to label it.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting how the regulations in the US actually came about, because when they were first genetically engineered, crops were actually originally introduced in the US, and at the time the Food and Drug Administration raised serious concerns about the potential health impacts of GE food, and because they were completely new foods that have never existed before, the plants had never existed before in nature, the regulators were really keen to have proper testing done. But obviously companies like Monsanto were really keen to not have any testing done. They wanted to bring these products to market as quickly as they possibly could. And they were intensively lobbying the US government to pave a pathway to market for these products so that it could lead the world in this technology. So what it was quite interesting, the US government's response to this, because they basically appointed a senior Monsanto employee, Michael Taylor, who used to work for Monsanto as an attorney. They actually appointed him as deputy commissioner of the US Food and Drug Administration, and he oversaw the approval basically of GE crops in the US. So under the current US legislation, no testing is required of genetically engineered foods before they're released onto the market, which is extremely worrying for US consumers, but it's also worrying for Australian consumers as well, because our food regulator here, Food Standards Australia New Zealand, basically seems to approve everything that the US government approves.
It's so kind of a rubber stamp almost, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So far they've approved every single GE food that's come across their door, including alpha amylase maize, which has been approved nowhere else in the world apart from the US. And the main justification that Suzanne's gave for approving that corn was that it had already been approved in the US. So they accepted that there were concerns raised by industry about the potential health impacts of the corn, but they've approved it anyway, because they're worried about action from the US through the free trade agreement. Our regulator is just following the line that the US regulator follows, which has been basically written by Monsanto.
Right, yeah.
So it just shows how much influence companies like Monsanto have on our regulators, isn't it? And it's really quite disturbing. So we're actually calling for proper independent safety testing of GE foods before they're released onto the market, and also, as I mentioned, for the proper labelling. So we've actually got a petition at the moment. It's on our website, which is www.truefood.org.au.
Okay, so that's
We've got 25,000 people have signed the petition, and we're hoping to get a lot more.
Terrific. Yeah, that's www.truefood.com.au, was it?
Yeah, truefood.org.
Sorry, .org.au. Yeah, okay, great. I haven't heard of that one, actually. Look, you know, something interesting to me, I mean, this question of why they don't want to have the labelling, if they really believed that genetically modified foods were so good and so safe and so harmless, why would they be concerned about having them labelled? I mean, it's almost like an admission that they know there's something wrong with it. I mean, this is always something I've found peculiar. Because,
yeah, well,
I mean, they should be proud of it.
That if GE foods are labelled, that consumers will reject them. So Europe's actually got much better labelling laws than Australia has when it comes to GE foods. So in Europe, even highly processed ingredients such as canola oil have to be labelled as such. So what we've seen in Europe is huge market rejection. No companies want GE canola oil because they don't want to have to label their products, because they know if they're labelled, consumers won't buy them. And that's why companies like Monsanto are lobbying really, really strongly against labelling. And so is the US government, because of the revolving door between Monsanto and the US government. So the US at the moment, through the international negotiations, the codex negotiations that are going on with regard to GE foods,
did you say the codex?
Actually trying to block labelling, international labelling regulations through that mechanism. And they're trying to use the free trade agreement and the World Trade Organization to put pressure on companies to roll back their labelling laws, basically, and weaken them.
Understood. Did you say the codex negotiations before?
That's right. Yeah. So that's an international framework where they discuss issues around GE foods.
Yeah. Well, this is something that that I've come across before. Some quite alarming things about the Codex Alimentarius international trade framework that has been developed. How do you feel about that? I mean, what I've discovered through my research, and there's been a few documentaries made about it as well, that the Codex Alimentarius looks like a standards based organization, and at face value that sounds terrific. We should have good standards. We should have everything should be the best quality, but then others have probed more into what this organization is trying to do in terms of regulating our foods. And there have been some quite alarming things that I've read, that they're actually trying to restrict what we can and cannot buy according to some, international trade agreements. Are you familiar with any of that?
I'm afraid that's not a topic that I'm a huge expert on,
okay.
I have to say.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly there's some elements of Codex that are quite good. Certainly they're doing a lot of work looking at the way that the safety of GE foods should be assessed, and the Codex recommendations for assessing the safety of GE food are certainly stronger than the safety assessment that we have for GE foods in Australia. It doesn't mean that they're perfect, but it's like any international agreement. It's a grindingly slow process, and it's never going to be world's best practice, just because they have to get international agreements from all the different countries involved.
Sure.
With obviously the US being one of the stronger countries involved, and having a huge vested interest in GE crops. So 50% of, just to get in perspective, 50% of all GE crops are currently grown in the US.
Okay.
And 85% are grown in American countries. So we've got the US, Canada, Argentina, and Brazil are the four main G crop growing countries. So when the biotechnology industry says that GE crops have been adopted all over the world, it's really not true. They're still, the vast majority are confined to just those four countries, and obviously we're trying to make sure it stays that way.
Yeah. Do we currently have unlabeled GM foods in our supermarkets?
Yeah, so in Australia, we're actually at a turning point at the moment, because until recently, the vast majority of our food has been GE-free. But last year was the first year that genetically engineered canola was introduced to our fields in New South Wales and Victoria. And although it was admittedly very small amounts, it's less than 0.5% of the total crop, and that's going to be making its way into our food this year. And because canola oil is highly processed, and canola meal that's fed to animals doesn't have to be labelled either, and
right,
then none of the products resulting from canola, GE canola, are going to have to be labelled. And canola oil is actually used in a wide range of different products, including canola oil, margarine, and a wide range of processed foods as well. And
right,
so it's basically, Monsanto is trying to sneak these products onto our supermarket shelves unlabelled, and consumers have really got no way of knowing what's in our food.
Well, I can tell you, I've been avoiding canola oil for a few years now since I first started hearing about these things. I just use olive oil, you know, and I prefer the extra virgin. You know, I try to keep my stuff down to things that, you know, has some reasonable chain of where it came from. But anyway, that's just me.
Yeah, I also tend to avoid canola oil as well.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of, like, busy mums really haven't got time to run around the supermarket, checking packaging, and they just tend to grab what's there. But I think if you ask them, certainly the polling that was commissioned last year showed that 54% of Australian consumers don't want to eat GE food. So that's the majority of Australian consumers don't want to eat GE food, and yet we're having the GE food slammed down our throat and are not being provided with the information that we need to make an informed choice about the foods that we're eating.
Well, you know, Louise, I mean, that this phenomenon of, you know, a large majority of people not wanting to, you know, something that's forced on them, it's something that we talk about a lot on Truth News Radio, and we cover a lot of different topics that are you know, oriented towards freedom and democracy and values that we believe are important. And it seems very a pattern that's become very common these days, where government and corporations, and sometimes government and corporations together, just make decisions for us, and they don't seem to really care what we think. And it's do you think that we can make a difference? I mean, I want to be optimistic here, but there's a lot of reason to be pessimistic as well when you see the practices that have gone on in the US, and you see how closely we follow. I mean, I wonder what we can do to bring this to a head.
Well, that's certainly a problem. And the reason that YGE crops have got into Australia is basically a powerful elite who are mostly research interests that have got exclusive access to the government and are basically putting pressure on them to provide a pathway to market for GE crops. So
right.
You look, there's major research organisations like CSIRO have got vested interests. They've got patents in GE crops, and they've got strategic partnerships with companies like Monsanto. We've got the Grains Research and Development Corporation as well, has also got strategic partnerships with Monsanto and Bayer. Seed producers stand to gain a lot because they can basically sell new seed every year. Farmers will no longer be able to save their seeds with genetically engineered crops, which is a huge boon for the seed producers. They get to sell much more seed. So it's these powerful interests that are promoting this technology in Australia, and they've basically co-opted our universities by providing them with funding, and they've co-opted farming organisations by providing them with funding as well. I think the only real way to fight them is by mobilising consumers, because ultimately if consumers don't buy GE products, then there's no market for them, and the technology will die. So I think that's really where our strength lies, because the vast majority of Australian consumers don't want to eat GE food. So it's just the important thing is to provide them with the information that they need to avoid GE foods, and encourage them to put pressure on decision makers and also on companies to reject GE foods. So we've actually produced a True Food Guide, which basically rates companies on whether they use the GE ingredients or not. So companies are rated green if they're GE free, and red if they use GE ingredients. So it's a real simple pocket-sized guide that people can take to the supermarket with them to avoid GE crops. So people can either phone the Greenpeace office and ask for a copy of that guide, or you can search our online guide, which is on our website.
That sounds like a great way to move forward. And so we just need to get more and more people aware of what's going on. And I guess the question of labelling, I mean, if we could enforce labelling, that would basically deflect the problem, wouldn't it? I mean, if all genetically modified foods had, but then there's this problem of the cross-pollination or the contamination, and this is something we discussed a bit with Bob. You know, even if, let's say, they agreed to labeling, how do we stop the genetically modified genes just crossing into other crops? How do we stop it?
Yeah, well, that's right. You really can't, and that's certainly what we've seen in Canada, where GE canola was introduced there. Now 90% of non-certified non-GE canola is actually contaminated with GE materials, so it's a removed choice for both non-GE farmers and consumers. Right. And that's one of the major concerns that we've raised about the technology here, is that it's being released in Australia, but there's no recourse for non-GE farmers if their crops are contaminated with GE material, so that they could potentially lose their markets for non-GE canola as a result of that. But there's no recourse right. for them other than suing the GE farmer. But if they've got several neighbours that are growing it, it's going to be extremely hard to prove who's contaminated their crop.
Yeah.
And if they've basically followed the agreements as outlined by Monsanto, then there's going to really be very little recourse for non-GE farmers. So basically they're carrying all the financial risk. If they want to market their canola as GE-free, they have to get additional tests, and it's going to cost them more money to do that. So basically all the risk, all the financial burden is on the non-GE farmer, which is grossly unfair, because there's actually a study poll done last year by the Australian government which shown that only 27% of farmers actually want to grow GE crops. So it's a tiny percentage of farmers which are basically jeopardising the non-GE market for all the rest of farmers.
Because it actually costs more, doesn't it, to buy the Monsanto seed? It's not...
That's right, yeah. So there was actually the first independent studies looking at Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola were done last year by the Grains and Research Development Corporation. So they did field trials, and they actually found that in their field trials, the best GE canola variety actually yielded 10% less than the best non-GE variety, and yet it cost 15% more to grow. So it's a real no-brainer for farmers. So I think most farmers realise that it's a rot and they're not buying into it, but there are a few farmers that are really embracing the technology, but I don't imagine a lot of farmers taking it up, but it only requires a few to risk contaminating a whole load of farmers. That's our concern.
Have you seen the same phenomena here as what happens in America, where farmers are actually being litigated by Monsanto simply for inadvertently having GM, crops sprouting on their fields?
Yeah, that's certainly a problem that's happening in the US. In the US, Monsanto has actually got 500 staff and a budget of several million devoted solely to chasing farmers for patent infringement. So they basically come onto farmers' properties, test to see if their crop is Roundup crop. If it is, regardless of whether it's been accidentally contaminated from another farmer's field, then they take the farmer to court for a patent infringement. Yeah. Now, the government here has said that won't happen in Australia, but it actually doesn't have to happen in Australia, because our laws here are slightly different. So what Monsanto's arranged here with the grains bodies is to actually put a levy on at the point of delivery. So when farmers deliver their grain to the silo and their crops are tested, and if they contain any GE material, then Monsanto's able to just deduct a fee for the crop being GE, whether the farmer wanted it to be GE or not, and then it's down to the farmer to try and recover that if his crop has been accidentally contaminated. So here it's actually even more stacked than it was in the US. Monsanto doesn't have to sue farmers to recover costs for using GE crop. They can just deduct it straight away at the silo. So farmers are really getting stitched up here.
That's really worrying.
Okay.
Has there been, has this information, for example, about the the 10% deficit in the yield. Has this been presented in the form of a scientific paper or something that, that we can, you know, get hold of, that people can find to confirm that what you're saying is true? Because often, you know, there's claims and they say, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory or whatever.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So if you go to the Grains Research and Development Corporation, they've got a National Variety Trials website.
Right.
And if you look, if you look on there, there's a paper called G. Canola Trials, and that's got all the data from the National Variety Trials
right.
up there.
And so who conducted that study?
So that was the Grains and Research and Development Corporation. So they're
right.
they're independent trials, basically. So Monsanto will try and claim that there's actually a yield benefit associated with GE canola, but none of the trials that they quote are independent. They're all company trials, basically, and so therefore of dubious quality. And this, yeah, these Grains Research and Development Corporations are the only genuinely independent trials that have been done in Australia.
Right. Okay. So there's some hope there that we might get some sense into this debate if some of the information can get through.
Yeah, I think as soon as a lot of farmers saw those trials, they realized that it's all spin. There's no substance. There's no evidence from anywhere in the world that GE crops increase yield. Basically, the industry just keeps repeating this mantra that there's an environmental benefit. We need GE crops to feed the world, and they increase yield. But there's no evidence of that any of those things are true. In actual fact, we've seen serious environmental problems associated with GE crops. We've seen a decrease in yield associated with GE crops, and what GE crops do in the developing world is just concentrate the control of the food supply in the hands of a few giant multinationals, which is actually extremely dangerous when it comes to food security. And it also means that farmers can no longer save their seed, which is really important for poorer farmers. They don't have the money to buy new seed every year, especially expensive GE seed.
Indeed, yeah, that's one of the things that's the most disturbing about this, and also that that Monsanto has been acquiring all these other seed companies so that they can own more and more of the actual seed stock in the world. Do you know what, you know, how much of it they own at this point?
Well, certainly Monsanto's, been going on a giant spending spree, buying up as many seed companies around the world as they can. And it's become really clear that their agenda is basically to try and control as much of the seed world seed supply as they can. In terms of genetically engineered seed, Monsanto owns 90% of all the GE seed in the world. So they really are the major player.
Yeah.
And it's become clear that what they want to do is, control the seed supply, make it so that farmers can no longer save their seed, and they have to buy new seed every year. They have to buy the chemical inputs prescribed by Monsanto to go with that seed, and they're basically trying to stitch up the whole food supply chain. It's an extremely clever market strategy as far as Monsanto is concerned, but it's also extremely dangerous when it comes to world food sovereignty and security.
Yeah, there seems to be like a mixture of like really predatory behavior and really negligent practices. I mean, you know, in this film that you're going to be attending on Saturday, they go into some of the history of the other failed or disastrous things that Monsanto was involved in. They cover the subject of PCBs, which I think that was a preservative. Are you up to speed on those, on PCBs?
PCBs, I'm not actually sure that what they were used for.
I've forgotten as well.
They're extremely dangerous, and Monsanto basically, covered up evidence. They knew for years that they were harmful to human health, and yet they kept them on the market because they were concerned about losing income. And the same, happened with Agent Orange as well. Monsanto still today claims it's safe, despite it being associated with horrific birth defects in people that were exposed to it in Vietnam. So Monsanto will basically go to any lengths to try and keep their unsafe products on the market, including bribing officials, falsifying evidence, and
They've
made it clear they'll stop at nothing.
The fact that they collaborated so closely with the military-industrial complex in the Vietnam War, I mean, you know, doesn't say much, you know. I mean, the entire North Vietnam was completely deforested, you know, and this was a deliberate campaign of just environmental, you know, genocide that they were involved in. So, it doesn't look good, does it? It doesn't look promising.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And then, of course, we've got the studies that whistleblowers have pointed to from some of them who were working for government, some of them who were connected to Monsanto, that showed liver enlargement in laboratory rats who were eating, I think, the Monsanto soy, increased mortality, a lot of things there that really don't, and on a common sense level, and this is what I kind of, because I like to bring things down to something that the average person can just relate to, the very concept of having breeding a crop to be immune to a pesticide, it just seems wrong, you know? Like, you don't want to do that. I mean, the pesticide kills plants, and then you put a gene into that plant to make it immune, and then you say, oh, it's totally safe to eat.
That's right, yeah. So there's a whole range of concerns that have been raised about genetically engineered crops, including increased herbicide residues, because you're obviously... What genetically engineered crops mean is that farmers not only spread herbicide on the field before they plant the crop, they can also spray more herbicide on the crop whilst it's in the ground. So the biotechnology industry line that GE crops reduce herbicide use is just a farce. As we've seen in the US, there's been a huge increase in herbicide use as a result of the adoption of GE crops there. Concerns have been raised by independent scientists that there might be byproducts of the herbicides remaining in the final GE crop that might be consumed by humans. And as you've mentioned, there's a whole lot of other studies that have raised serious concerns about the health impacts of eating GE foods. So there was a variety of GE corn that has been approved in Australia, M1863. And studies that were actually done by Monsanto showed increased liver and kidney toxicity, evidence of liver and kidney toxicity in rats that were fed the maize. Now, Monsanto originally tried to hide that evidence, but was forced to release it after Greenpeace basically took them to court in Germany. Okay. And finally that data was revealed. But yet our regulator in Australia has still taken no action to ban that crop or to even require further studies. So they still rubber stamped it as safe despite it showing serious adverse effects in animals.
Very, very, very unprofessional practices there, and it can only just lead to people to think that there's financial rewards, under the table or whatever for collusion with these organisations. You know, when we've seen it so many times, there's various levels of corruption that exist.
Yeah, and that's certainly, I mean, it's not just GE crops. I mean, Fazans has been criticised on a number of levels for being too close to industry. It's not just GE crops, also food additives. There's a number of food additives that are approved in Australia that have been banned in Europe. Yet our regulators have taken no action to protect consumers here. And so Greenpeace is actually calling for an independent review of Fazans and the way it operates, because we think it's basically pandering to the interests of giant multinationals rather than protecting the health of consumers.
Sure. How do you spell that?
It's FSANZ, so it's Food Standards Australia New Zealand.
Okay. So yeah. they're the ones that should be protecting us and keeping
that's
our best
right.
interests.
So that's the regulator charged with ensuring food safety. And we believe they're failing miserably when it comes to not only GE crops but another number of other foods as well.
Okay. just was wondering if you could maybe recap what Greenpeace sort of active actions Greenpeace is doing. I saw something on your site there today that you did a couple of weeks ago, I think, were outside the Intercontinental Hotel. What was that all about?
Yeah, so we had a protest on the 1st of May outside the Intercontinental Hotel in Sydney. That was the Food Regulation Ministerial Council meeting, and that happens twice a year and involves the health ministers from all the states and the federal government as well.
Okay.
And they were meeting to discuss food labelling. Basically, so they've committed to conduct a comprehensive independent review of food labelling, which is great. So we're pushing to ensure that genetically engineered foods are included in that review, and that the right of consumers to know what they're eating is assured when it comes to GE crops. So that's one thing that people can do when the inquiry is actually launched, is make a submission saying that you want all GE crops labelled as such. So we'll be putting information on our website as and when we know more about what's going to be in that review and how people can make submissions.
Great. And I guess when you speak at the film on Saturday, you'll be able to give the people who come some ideas as to what they can do, any suggestions, materials or whatever like that you've got.
That's right. And something that people can always do is write to their state health minister and their federal health minister. And contact details for them are also on our website. www.truefood.org.au. So I'd encourage people to go there and find out how you can take action. Remarkably few people actually write to their MPs and decision makers nowadays, so it really does make a difference when people take the time to sit down and write something, because I think people are so disillusioned with our decision makers, probably quite rightly so, very few people actually write to them, so they do take notice when people do take the time to do it.
Yeah, there's there's a necessity there for the public servant to respond. I've seen a few people. Another issue that I've been quite concerned about is the freedom of the internet and internet censorship. We've had a few people I know have written letters to Stephen Conroy, the Minister for Communication, and a big long reply. They do have to reply, although what you usually find, it's very kind of circumlocutory, like they'll actually have a prepared response. I think it does, the more of those letters they get, the more unsettled, the more they realise that there's an issue here. And I guess there's a tipping point, when they realise that that a large part of their constituency isn't happy, then they have to respond because that's their job. Let's hope.
That's right. And I think it's important not to stop at one letter either, because you're right, the first one's always a form letter that they've pre-prepared.
Yeah.
But if
yeah.
you then write back picking holes in their response, then they're compelled to write you a proper response, basically.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true. We're probably getting close to the end here, but I just was wondering maybe what else you can tell us about what Greenpeace is up to in Australia, because we've got a listenership of people who are quite diverse in their interests. I think the people that are listening to Truth News are often freedom, free speech, civil liberties oriented in their thinking. And truth and justice type issues are very important. I'm not hugely aware of what Greenpeace is actually doing in Australia. Can you just give a quick rundown?
Are you just talking about on genetically engineered crops or more broadly?
Well, I was just wondering more broadly if you've got that info, maybe.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So we've got four main campaigns in Australia. There's
right.
climate change, which is obviously the overwhelming issue that we're working on at the moment. So the vast majority of our resources are being focused on that because of the urgency of the situation.
Right, right.
We've also got a campaign on forests. We're actually Greenpeace Australia Pacific.
Okay.
So we work not only on Australia, but also in the Pacific. So places like Fiji and PNG and the Solomon Islands and the rest of the region. So we've got a forest campaign, which is largely based in PNG.
Okay.
Trying to stop illegal logging there and protect forests. And we've also got an oceans campaign to try and clamp down on illegal fishing in the Pacific and to get in place marine reserves. And then we've also got the genetic engineering campaign as well. So that's got a few different strands.
We're working
with farmers to try and educate farmers so that they're aware of the risks associated with GE crops. And then we're also working with the food industry to try and stop them from using GE crops. And then we're also obviously campaigning for proper labelling of GE food as well, so that consumers can make an informed choice about the foods that they eat.
Great. Thanks for that. That's really great. Do you get a lot of farmers responding? Do you have a lot of farmers on your mailing list? Are they, how's that going?
We've got quite close links with quite a few farmers. Obviously, the wider rural community is probably a bit suspicious of Greenpeace and probably Greenies more broadly, but there are some other organisations that do work with farmers. So there's a group called the Network of Concerned Farmers, if you Google them, they've got a really, really great website. And it's run by a whole network of farmers in Australia, and they're doing some really great work in educating other farmers and also lobbying decision makers to try and get their views heard.
Sounds good. Network of Concerned Farmers. We'll put some of these links up on the blog page.
I think it's www.nongmfarmers.org.
Okay.
Along those lines.
And truefoods.org.au.
That's right.
Yeah, great. Okay, that's been really excellent, Louise. Thank you for so much.
Thank you so much for getting me on the program.
And looking forward to meeting you on Saturday night. And I think we've got quite a few. We don't know how many coming. There was no RSVP, but I do know that one organic farmer from Orange is coming because she called me. So we've got at least one farmer coming. Yeah. So, it's great. Thank you so much. And we'll be seeing you.
Great. Thanks for your time, and we'll see you on Saturday night.
Okay. Cheers.
Okay. Thanks, Ben.
Cheers.
Bye.
This is Lucinda Williams singing "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall" by Bob Dylan.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, it's hard. It's hard, it's hard, it's hard. Rain's gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? Oh, what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared. and it's hard. It's hard. It's hard. It's hard. Oh, what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back out before the rain starts to fall in. I'll walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison, where the executioner's face is well hidden, where hunger is ugly and souls are forgotten, where black is the color and none is number. I tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it. I reflect it from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I stand on the ocean until I start singing. I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's hard, it's hard.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back to Truth News Radio Australia. And welcome, a huge big welcome to Josh Jackson. Hi, Josh.
Harrowood, another wonderful week.
Another amazing week. And we just had another great interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had Louise Sales from Greenpeace Australia Pacific on the show, and she did an awesome job. She covered a lot of ground there. And,
this show is only going onward and upward.
Yeah, yeah, and hopefully not inward.
No. And I actually like to put it out there, folks, if you want to advertise on the show, we've got some spots available. Just contact, what's the best email there, Harold?
Contact editor at truthnews.com.au. You can see that link if you go to our site. If you go to truthnews.com.au, you can click on the contact option there.
Yeah. A lot going on.
There's a lot. Look, I've got a whole... I tell you what. I stuck my finger in the griller earlier in between segments. Just a confession here of my own incompetence. And I've got a sore finger, but I'll try and soldier through that.
I've actually broken two fingers in taekwondo practice, so I've got it all bandaged up. So we're fingerless.
Okay, so we're well matched.
Yeah.
Now look, I've got a bunch of stories here which are all kind of disparate. They're all kind of like they're all important, and you know, in the absence of like a brilliantly organized production, schedule, I'm going to go through what I've got here in no particular order, and I'm going to get your comments and your observations on some of these quite interesting stories we want to look at tonight, Josh. I want to start with a local story. It's always good to, get back to where we are. Instead of, we cover a lot of stuff that is things going on the other side of the planet, and, it's important too. But
playground, yeah.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. But look, here's a story that really brings it all back home. A Brisbane couple lost their $315,000 home over a credit card debt of $8,000, only finding out after the home was sold for $20,000 at a bailiff's auction. The first they knew about it was when the new owner, who had to pay the couple's outstanding $220,000 mortgage, phoned them and said, "Get out." Legal Aid Queensland lawyer Catherine Orr said the couple were not even given notice of the auction. Now, apparently this is not the first time. This is not the only case. If you follow the article, which we'll post on the blog, there's been quite a few cases like this of, well, it's really, it looks like almost a conspiracy between the credit card companies and the banks, because often it's credit cards that are tied to a bank. And people have a small unpaid debt on their credit card, and what do you know? They lose their house.
It's this sort of predatory behavior that happens, especially in times of economic downturns. This is a typical sort of stuff that happened in the 1930s as well, with in America, where the banks would literally buy up whole areas because they'd go broke. I mean, it's happened again, where banks sort of, they turn on the taps, give a lot of free credit out for a decade, and then they just turn it off. They just turn off the money, and that's what we're seeing here, really. I mean, they're turning off liquidity and buying up properties and businesses for pennies on the dollar, or pennies on the pound, or cents on the dollar, whichever way you want to look at it. And it's nothing new. And then, like you said, you've got this sort of partnership with liquidators or debt collectors, where they just literally have this massive predatory behavior against people that are, further on in that story, it goes on about someone who had, a nice four-bedroom house worth, $385,000, and he had a credit card debt of $5,000, and it was only 5 days before it was, about to go to court that he actually found out and put a stop to it.
Yes, in some cases, people are only finding out by accident that their house has been put up for auction. It looks like predatory behavior to me.
Well, what happens? I mean, it's happened to me, actually. One of my businesses, when I was, I was running this business, and basically we'd paid we had an outstanding invoice with a courier company, a big one, and I paid it, but I put in the wrong account number over the internet banking. And I was also moving house at the time, and I it actually bounced back to me, the payment, but I didn't recognize that, and it was all this thing of moving, and I just didn't give them the new address because I thought, well. But these guys didn't look very hard, because it's very easy to find me. I mean, it's not hard if you're an agent, a credit agency or whatever. And they just didn't bother. They just took me straight to court without me knowing, down in Melbourne. I'm in Sydney.
Right.
And the next thing I know is I'm 2 years later, I'm trying to go for a mobile phone contract, and I get declined because I've got a bad credit rating. They've put a default on my credit rating. And literally, I find out, they took me to court. There was a whole court hearing, all this stuff, without me even there. I mean, I didn't even know about this. I mean, lucky. It's only a small credit card. It's only a small little debt of $1,000. They couldn't do anything because I didn't have any property. But if I had property or something, they would have just gone for that.
Well, I don't think they could have done it unless... You see, I think the reason why they can do it in these cases, is because the people who owe money to a bank. See, they've borrowed money from a bank, and they've put their house up for mortgage.
Yeah.
And then they've got a credit card, which is also controlled by the bank.
Mm.
So... as far as I know, it's not possible. For example, let's say you own, let's say you borrow money from Fred Smith, okay, and you buy a house through a bank, right, and then you default on repaying Fred Smith your loan. Well, yeah. Fred Smith can't go and just take your house. That cannot happen.
No.
Under our system.
They can liquidate your business.
But that, then there's a court proceeding that has to go in place and you have to be there.
Yeah.
You have to be at that court proceeding, or you have to be notified of the court proceeding.
It's incredible. They just have their own rules, don't they, banks?
I think there's probably some fine print in the contract that these people signed, that they've signed away some of their rights there, and they're probably not aware of it, I would guess. Because what's happening here is that these people have, they've got an arrangement with the bank. They may be making their loan repayments to the bank, but they're reneging on their credit card payments, but somehow it's all tied together.
A lot of people this is a big problem with Western society at the moment, and with especially in Australian society, is that people always straight away go, the government's got to do something. They've got to pass laws against this sort of predatory behavior. And I just say, look, no. First of all, I mean, this is my opinion. First of all, people that get into credit card debts and get into these debts need to know their fine print. You need to really understand what you are getting yourselves into with debts, and especially with mortgages. Because these banks can get you, and yeah, they use a whole lot of language, and that's why it's really important to have a good mortgage broker to talk to explain everything to you in black and white. And realize that they can just take your house. They can just do it. So, you know, I mean, if it's there in contract, that's, you know, you've only got yourself to blame, really.
Yeah, well...
I mean, I don't agree with the predator behavior. Don't get me wrong. I think it's disgusting that they don't even bother trying to find you or talk to you, you know. Especially with the internet and everything, you know, really it's not hard to find people these days. So it is rather disgusting. But I'm not going to call for a big law to be passed and all this stuff. I just think people need to take more responsibility for themselves. And really, you know, really be due diligent with this sort of stuff. Saying that, you know, these banks do take advantage of the uneducated and the desperate and all sorts, you know.
And at a time when the government is encouraging people to go into a frenzy of house buying, the rate of new home ownership, first home ownership, is greater than it's ever been at the moment. And that's because they've lowered interest rates to the lowest they've been in decades. And they're even giving you substantial grants just for buying a house. You get this free money from the government. So, you know, you can't really blame people for being persuaded by all this pressure to do it. And of course, all the programming they've had, all of the advice they've ever had is that you should own your own house. You should own your own house. You know, it's a symbol of your success. It's a symbol of the fact that you're going to be a good member of society and take care of your family. And, you know, they've put all this...
Oh, it's the great Australian dream.
They've put all this programming into people about buying their own house. And, of course, the fine print is what people don't really want to know about. They want to have the... And it's an illusion. I see it as an illusion. Because when you have a massive mortgage, you don't own it, okay? And that's the basic... That's what it really comes down to. I mean... In fact, you can even forget the fine print, because the point is, if you owe 90% of the equity in what you've bought, you don't own it.
No.
You know, I mean, you know, it's as simple as that. If you own, say, 60% of the equity, then you can start to feel that you own it to some extent, you know. But unless you actually own it 100%, there is the potential that it could be taken away from you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's happened in the past, folks. You know, people just they get into trouble and they only own, you know, they only owe, you know, 10 grand or something on the house, and they fall sick or something, they can't make their payments on the last 10 grand of, you know, $300,000 loan, and the bank will just take the house, you know.
Oh, it's just so sad, isn't it? I mean, look, this has been happening in America, right across America. It happened with people who were who did everything right, who followed the rules, who were decent people. And then the banks put up the interest rates higher and higher and higher. And they
Who I really feel for right now at this stage, is people that are being suckered into buying a place in a frenzy right now because of this first homeowner's grant. Folks, the way economics works is that, yeah, the government's giving you $21,000 for a brand new home. But guess what, folks? Brand new homes are just going up by $21,000. They're just $21,000 more expensive.
That's going to be factored in, isn't it? Yeah.
It's all factored in. And that's how markets work. They realize that, there's $21,000 everyone's got and a little extra. So, we'll just bump it up. And it might not be, exactly that, but that's what happens. And once this first homeowner's grant finishes, guess what? House prices will drop by, 14,000 to 21,000, around about that over the next, couple of years, 6 months, couple of years. That's just what happens because it's a false economy. You can't prop up. So people feel like, oh, I'm getting all this free money. Well, A, first of all, it's your money that they're giving back to you. It's stolen from everyone else. And B, it's a false economy. It's bubble creating. This is the reason we have bubbles. Is governments going in there and propping them up and falsifying the value of places, of markets. So it's really important that people understand that and to understand that Australia is the last place in the world, in the Western world, that still got ridiculous price. You can buy an amazing mini little, like a small castle in, overlooking the ocean in parts of Europe for, $120,000. You can buy another place in London, England, you can buy another place in America for $500,000. You've got three places around the world. Here, you buy a place in Surrey Hills, some pokey little spot.
Yeah.
That doesn't even have a garden, doesn't have nothing. It's just one bedroom little place for $500,000. Australia is so overpriced, it's not funny. The population is so tiny here and we've got so much land. Our house prices have been artificially jacked up to the absolute maximum. If you think, if you really believe that house prices are going to keep on going up, I'm no expert, but I really cannot see house prices steadily on the increase. I see it. There has to be a crash somewhere.
Well, the only way house prices can go up is if everything else goes up with it. Wages will have to go up, and that means food costs will go up, and everything will go up.
Inflationary.
And it's been inflationary all this time, And look, one last thing to remind our listeners is the etymological derivative of the word mortgage is actually grip of death. Okay, that's what the word means. Think about it.
Yeah,
it goes back to medieval times. It really means that you are indentured. It's kind of an evolution of the indentured serfdom that used to exist in feudal times. And it means that you are in your body, in a sense, is in the grip. You're unto death. I think some mortgages used to actually have that as part of the way it was structured.
Look, if you were just to stick, say you're renting, right, and you then go and figure out how much the place you is, and you pay the difference from what you're paying in rent to what you would be paying with a mortgage, and save that. And put it in a high interest account with, some good compounding, and did that for 30 years, the same as the standard mortgage, you would have about $2 million saved up. Now, a house has to you pay interest on a house about three times on average of what the house is worth. So if you buy a, $300,000 loan, you're going to end up paying $900,000 back. That house has to triple in price and this and that. Look. And I mean, I'm not taking the problem with that scenario is in 30 years, the $1 million through inflationary pressure is going to be worth less as well. So there is all that to play. And we're not saying houses aren't a good thing to buy. They are. And if you're clever, you can use, you know, ways to use the bank's money to buy more places. But this is in a growth time. You can do that. But I really am in the firm belief that houses shouldn't be the place of speculators. It shouldn't be an investment portfolio. I mean, yeah, it always has been and that, but it should be a place to live in, folks. It's a place to keep the rain off your head. And this sort of baby boomer greed that's happened in Australia has really, you know, I mean, it's priced so many people out of the market. It's unbelievable. I mean, people that have got, you know, $120,000 salaries, you know, can't afford to buy a house in Sydney unless they go way out yonder, if they're brand new home owners, but without buying in some really crusty place, tiny sort of pokey pad. But then, you know, that's totally overpriced, and I'd be worried that they'd lose their value in the house eventually anyway, because it can't sustain it.
Yeah. Okay. So, point taken, point given.
Bit of a rant there, but you know, if people are clever, there's always ways to make money in property. I'm not saying you can't, and you definitely can. A lot of people have, but I'd just be wary at these times. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, well, I think we're going to move on now, because we've got a few more burning issues to look at, and I tell you the next one I'm gonna hit, Josh. The title of the story is G20 Police Used Undercover Men to Incite Crowds. This nice. Was published in The Guardian last week.
Wow.
And this is quite an alarming story. This is from London, okay? And this is at the recent G20 protests. The London police were infiltrating the protests, and then they were inciting violence from within the crowd. I'll just read you a bit more of the story. MP demands inquiry into Met tactics at demo. An MP who was involved in last month's G20 protests in London is to call for an investigation into whether the police used agents provocateurs to incite the crowds. Liberal Democrat Tom Brake says he saw what he believed to be two plainclothes police officers go through a police cordon after presenting their ID cards. Brake, who along with hundreds of others was corralled behind police lines near Bank Tube Station in the City of London, says he was informed by people in the crowd that the men had been seen to throw bottles at the police and had encouraged others to do the same shortly before they passed through the cordon. Brake, a member of the influential Home Affairs Select Committee, will raise the allegations when he gives evidence before the Parliament's Joint Committee on Human Rights. When I was in the middle of the crowd, two people came over to me and said, "There are people over there who we believe are policemen and who have been encouraging the crowd to throw things at the police." But when the crowd became suspicious of the men and accused them of being police officers, the pair approached the police line and passed through after showing some identification.
It's actually very similar to what happened in Montreal, in Canada, during the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, those protests there. The exact same thing happened. You had all these cops, these so-called protesters throwing stuff at the cops, carrying bricks around in their hand or something like that, and in this total peaceful demonstration, and they were wearing the same boots as the cops, and a couple of the real protesters got really suspicious, saying, "Who are these guys with full-on, like, you know, hankies over their face, looking really aggro with bricks in their hand?" And said, "Hey, they're cops, started saying they're cops, they're agent provocateurs." And they got them up against the wall, and then they escaped. The police helped them escape and sort of half-tackled them, and then heaps of photos came out of that, and they were wearing the same boots, the army or the police, you know, boots as everyone, as the other police. And, you know, later turns out that the police then did admit to that being true. I mean, it happens over and over again. It happened, you know, United States, the whole COINTELPRO of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, you know, they did it plenty of times with the Black Panthers and stuff like that.
Now, what they have admitted to in this case is that they put observers into the crowd, and they say that they need that so that they can effectively manage the situation, you know, so they can survey what is going on. But I think I'll just read to you here from what it says. And this is a quote from somebody, Sir Paul Stevenson. There is a logic having plainclothes officers in the crowd, but no logic if the officers are actively encouraging violence, which would be a source of great concern.
Oh, there is logic, because the logic behind it is we need to spend more and become more of a police state. We need to get new water cannons, new hardware, and they need to justify newly purchased hardware as new tasers, new cannons, water cannons, new, and there's full on new technology, like denial of serve, sort of these beam technologies that just burn your skin and make everyone run away, like these big satellite dishes that point at crowds and just you start to
heat weapons,
microwaves or something at you. And this is no joke, folks. You can go look it up yourself. I mean, these are, I've forgotten what they're called, denial of.
Wide area denial or remote area denial or
something like
Taser
that.
International has a weapon that they've devised for that purpose. It says here that the use of plainclothes officers is considered a vital tactic for gathering evidence, and it has been used effectively to combat football hooliganism in the UK and was employed during the May Day protests in 2001. So, see, football hooliganism, a long-standing problem in the UK and elsewhere. And they can say, well... But, of course, you see, there's a fine line between putting an observer into the crowd. Well, it's not such a fine line. I mean, it's a pretty thick line, but, you know...
It's a long line
to say between putting an observer in the crowd and then actually making that observer act like he's actually a protester... And then going that one step further, which is, you know...
Carrying a brick.
Upping the level. Yeah, upping the ante.
Throwing it. And literally, there's been cases where cops these agent provocateurs will throw a brick into another cop's face. And it comes out later because the cop that gets the face smashed in gets so pissed off that they end up dobbing, they end up... actually, exposing it, because they're just like, I can't believe we did this all just to, justify whatever the justification is. But it does happen, folks. And this is another reason why it's very, very important not to just be like, oh, look at these violent protesters, when it's, of course, the media just shows the violence. And this then is a call, and the next 3 weeks after the protest is like all these police ministers saying, we're lobbying government right now to get new military hardware, become more of a paramilitary force to these despicable acts. These aren't peaceful. We have no problems with peaceful protests and all this sort of stuff. It happens time and time again. I guess what we're saying here on this show is protect your freedoms, folks, because that's how they disappear, by being gullible, by being like without question saying, oh, okay, so, inciting violence. I mean, we had the APAC summit here, we had some boys that were on a black list, some girls as well, because they'd, caused trouble at some other event in Melbourne. And they weren't allowed, apparently, to...
It was totally illegal.
It's totally unconstitutional. They weren't allowed to step foot in Sydney. Now, they challenged that because it's totally illegal.
They had no criminal record.
No. And I saw one of them, and this was with my own eyes. He was sitting in the park, because this was all in the main park of Sydney. What's that park called there, Harold?
Well, it was probably Hyde Park,
I think. Yeah, Hyde Park, that's the one. And he was sitting there. There's this cafe there, and it was open. And he was having a cup of coffee. He was sitting down having a cup of coffee. All of a sudden, all these cops in full-on black uniform, like stormtrooper-style uniforms, ran up to him, and I was thinking, hey, what's going on here? Ran up to the guy, grabbed him, pulled him off of his seat. His coffee goes flying. They slammed him down on this ground, put their knee in the back. Meanwhile, all of the crowd start circling around this action and start chanting, you know, leave him alone. 2, 4, 6, 8, this is not a police state. They were basically, I mean, so what you have here is not agent provocateurs that were pretending to be. This is basically police trying to incite violence in the crowd, because this crowd was very sort of hyped up and bored and ready to go. But they were very peaceful as well. They were just chanting and stuff. But if the police grabbed this guy, which they did, put him down on the ground, knees in the back, about 12 of them. And, of course, what's the crowd going to do? They're going to get angry and pissed.
Absolutely.
And I was yelling out, be careful of agent provocateurs. Do not do anything. Do not react to this. You know, I was really trying to make sure that people weren't getting violent, because that's what they want, folks. They want violence. Don't kid yourself. Don't think, oh, they're just protecting us. They want peaceful demonstrations. They don't. They want a violent demonstration so they can up their power, up their budgets for new hardware. Absolutely. And new police powers.
Yeah. There's a little bit of clicking going on in your equipment there, Josh. I'm not sure whether that's...
That's this headset. I'll just fix that.
We'll just take a quick break. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Okay, we're back. Well, that was quite a sad situation, really, I think, what's happening for democracy in the United Kingdom, wouldn't you say, Josh?
It's a
sad situation, you know. More than anger, you know, I feel a sense of sorrow for the people whose children are going to be living with the legacy of this if we don't roll it back. The UK has gone further than many other countries in terms of restrictions on freedom. According to a recent report which I read today, the UK and the United States are rated 5th and 6th in the world in terms of the most repressive countries now. That's including all those other countries that we used to think of as terrible, despotic, you know, dictatorships all over the world. You know, the UK and the United States are not very far down that list.
Oh, no, exactly. I mean, I was watching The Bill the other day with my mum, and I just said to her, because every time they show all these, we got them on surveillance, and because they've got surveillance cameras on every street corner in Britain. I mean, it's unbelievable. It truly is a Big Brother state in terms of cameras. And I said, I can't believe that England's just turned into such a Big Brother Orwellian police state with these cameras everywhere. And Mum said straight away, oh, well, as long as it's, you know, it's stopping crime. And I said, well, actually, crime's gone up, funnily enough. Yeah, it doesn't
but see, they win either way. If crime's gone up, then, oh, well, they need it all the more then, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You can't win. With the control paradigm, with the problem-reaction-solution paradigm, you can't win. If you accept their basic premises, you're screwed. And because their basic premises are based on lies, as we see with the, you know, agent provocateurs in the crowd. If you don't question it right at the source, right where they're deceiving you, you've had it. You've got no chance at all. That's why the truth movement exists, okay? That's why there is a 9/11 truth movement. That's why there is a wider truth movement. That's why we have, through, you know, radio shows like this and groups around the world begun to make people aware of things like false flag terrorism, which has been around for probably thousands of years. I mean, I'm sure the ancient Greeks used to do it. I'm sure the Egyptians did it, because it's a strategy which is very effective. Okay? You know,
it's their favorite tool. It's their absolute favorite tool. It's been used thousands of times, and they've been caught thousands of times. I mean, just Google false flag terrorism.
It's a strategy of power. I mean, think about protection rackets and the mafia. What did they do? They'd go around, you know, saying to people, look, you better pay us some money to protect you because something bad could happen. And you know, then something bad happens. And they come back and say, well, you know, if you'd paid us the money, that bad thing wouldn't have happened.
Mm.
And of course, you know, everyone knows they did it. You know, they set fire to a restaurant or whatever they did back in those days, you know. Protection racket. It's well established, you know. For some reason, we've become sort of, our brains have been kind of coddled in cotton wool in the last few decades, you know, the last generation, and we're sort of pretending that we're not living in that kind of environment anymore. We're pretending that we live in this squeaky clean kind of, you know, free world. Most of my lifetime, I heard this phrase, the free world, and they always used to compare the free world to the terrible, you know, lack of freedoms behind the Iron Curtain, you know, the Eastern Europe and the unfree world, and now that was replaced with the Islamic Caliphate. You know, that was Dick Cheney's favorite expression.
Oh yeah, the Islamo-fascists.
Yes, yeah, and you know that's another terrible boogeyman that, you know, in all these terrible countries like Iran that have no freedom, you know, we have to support our freedom-loving,
even though they'll go over there and overthrow Mossadegh, who was democratically elected Iranian leader, because they didn't like him. So it's, you know,
we have to support our bloodthirsty military-industrial complex that goes around sabotaging and starting wars and, you know, napalming babies and destroying, you know, genocidal attacks on the infrastructure of other countries. And we have to support all of that because they believe in freedom.
I think a lot of people are waking up, Harold, and I'm very confident in that. I'm very confident because the more and more people I talk to, they go, yeah, I know. You know, Hitler burned down his own Reichstag, false flag, to you know, blame it on the communists and you know, Mossadegh got overthrown and the Lusitania got sank. And, you know, I mean, it goes on and on, and people are actually quite aware now. And but saying that, there's still a vast majority that are sound asleep and love watching e-news and get really, the only thing they get absolutely pissed off about is their, you know, football team losing. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, look, England, getting back to England, it is really a sad case. And it, folks, when your freedoms keep eroding, it is not good for anybody. It's not good. It's only good for the power elite. And this is important because a lot of people on the left and a lot of people on the right all think, oh no, the government's got to protect us, you know. It doesn't matter if you're left or right. This is an issue of basic human freedoms, freedom of creativity and freedom of movement, freedom of privacy. All these freedoms are being absolutely shat upon right now, and it's really important that we keep a lid on what government powers are getting and what police powers are getting, growing, what taxes are growing to support these, what wars are growing. you know, Obama going, oh, we're going to double the troops in Afghanistan now. I mean, this is all just despicable, more government growth, which is in turn going to take your freedom and my freedom.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's turn to a more positive note. I'd like to just cover a couple of new web portals that have popped up, which appears to be springing from, you know, the ability of human beings to resist tyranny. And one of them is actually from the UK. It's called ukcolumn.org. Have you heard of this organization, Josh?
I've only heard a little bit about them, only recently. But, yeah, look, this is the sort of stuff that people, you know, it's really wonderful that people are getting out there and building these networks. It's very important because, like we saw with YouTube shutting down and censoring the whole of Alex Jones's channel and now Burmese's channel, it's really important to diversify the freedom movement around the internet. And these sort of sites and our site and others like it and you folks at home, your sites, you know, it's really good.
I'll just read to you from a recent article posted on ukcolumn.org. Although I'm having a little problem with my browser, it's just frozen up. Unfortunately, it doesn't want to refresh. I'm having some bad luck here. I've got it up here. Okay, this is an article from their most recent article on their site, and it says it's got 34,000 people registered already on the site. Wanted: 1 million rebellious Britons reclaiming our sovereignty. Once again, we have reached a crossroads in our history. We are confronted with an enemy that would destroy our nation and its people. We have some hard decisions to make, each of us, individually. Are you prepared to make them? The British Constitution Group's call for lawful rebellion now moves up a notch, and our campaign, Wanted: 1 million Rebellious Britons, has commenced, to be formally declared at our conference in London on the 13th of June. If you share our ambition to take back control of our country, then we need your commitment and attendance at this conference, at which we will outline our strategy to build our campaign into a force to be reckoned with. There is a national mood for rebellion shared by patriots the length and breadth of the country. This must be harnessed under a single campaign with carefully defined objectives in order to win the war to claim back our sovereign right to govern ourselves. Make no mistake about it, this is a war. Fought by our enemies within this country with weapons of lies, deceit, subterfuge and betrayal. Their aim is to destroy the principle of the nation state and replace it with regionalized global dictatorship. In order to win, we must be prepared to tell the truth about our plight to our fellow Britons, the majority of whom exist in an awareness vacuum or a state of abstract denial. We cannot go to war without an army, and Wanted: 1 million Rebellious Britons is the foundation to building that army. We know that millions of our fellow countrymen and women share our views, but most have been rendered impotent, convinced there is nothing that we, the majority, can do to challenge the authority of a duplicitous minority. Now, the article goes on. I encourage everyone to go and have a look at it. We'll publish the link on the Truth News blog. There's a few things I really like about this site and in these articles. I mean, they're really well written. Okay, you can see that this is well constructed argument, but with strong language.
It's strong, isn't it? There's no beating around the bush there.
But it's extremely articulate. This is people who've got a good education, a good grasp of reality, a good intellectual ability, and also they're willing to fight. Okay,
when we say fight, it is very, very important to make this distinction. that I mean, I personally think it's absolutely appalling to have a fight using violence, because violence is their game, and violence is what they thrive on. This is the New World Order. This is the elite. They love it. I mean, that's why they constantly go into these third world countries and slaughter millions of people and farm all the guns and the ammo and the money towards it. I mean, they love it. And it's so important to have a non-violent resistance, but an aggressive non-violent resistance, if that makes sense.
I mean, there was nothing passive. If you think about what Gandhi did, okay, he was non-violent, but he wasn't passive.
That's right.
He was assertive.
Very active.
You know, you do need to take actions that will create conflict. It's not that you want the conflict, but sometimes you need the conflict in order for it to become, to reach that point where things have to change. Civil disobedience is one way of achieving that. Okay, I'm not actually, you know, saying to people, you know, go out and commit civil disobedience. What we've chosen to do here is to continue to be a beacon of knowledge and information. And sooner or later, I think that will, you know, what we're trying to do may provoke a response. And as you were mentioning before, Josh, two really huge YouTube channels have been shut down in the last week, one being the Alex Jones channel, the other one being the InfoWarrior channel that Jason Burma set up to replace the Alex Jones channel. This is what is finally happening.
I mean, whether you love or hate these people, it doesn't matter. This is basic freedom of speech and freedom of information that is being shut down here.
Yeah.
Being absolutely shut down.
And this is conflict. You know, this is engaging with an enemy. You know, the enemy is engaging with Alex Jones in this sense. They're saying we're going to shut you down, okay? But in doing that, it has a positive result for what we're trying to achieve, because thousands more people are now uploading their videos to all their own separate YouTube channels. Yeah. And this will take the struggle to the next level. We needed this to happen, okay?
Another... Sorry.
No, continue, yeah.
Another great website from the electronic, what are they called? The Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Oh, yes.
They've started a new website called the Surveillance Self-Defense website, which is basically a way of educating yourself on how to, you know, stop this ever-growing surveillance society that's developing around us. And how to you know, protect yourself from it. I'll just read a little bit. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has launched a new website called the Surveillance Self-Defense, designed to offer advice about the capabilities of US law enforcement and government surveillance capabilities and the things people can do to defend themselves. While this is a US-centric site, it offers good information, and read it well.
Great. And look, while we're on the topic of new websites, I just want to bring up another new one. This is from the United States, breakthematrix.com. And it's a big portal. It's a kind of a social networking portal as well, but it has a lot of original news and commentary. I'm going to play you something actually from this, from one of their regular people that speaks on here, a woman by the name of Shelley, who is their CTO. I'm going to just hit the play button here. And this particular story is quite interesting. The Cybersecurity Act of 2009 grants Obama power to shut down the internet and ignore laws. So we'll just kick off with a quick 2-minute clip here.
More of our freedoms are under attack, this time through S-773, the Cybersecurity Act of 2009. Introduced by Senators Rockefeller and Snow, this bill aims to improve security for critical technology systems within government and private sectors. In actuality, all this bill would do is vastly expand government's control by granting the president the authority to shut down internet traffic, regardless of whether it's in the government or the private sector. Worse yet, Section 14B states, the Secretary of Commerce shall have access to all relevant data concerning critical infrastructure networks, without regard to any provision of law, regulation, rule, or policy restricting such access. So basically, this provision authorizes the Secretary of Commerce to ignore any law protecting our privacy, like the Wiretap Act or the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which will allow the government virtually unrestricted access to our private data. This bill fits an alarming trend of legislation that massively expands the role and power of government while doing nothing to address the root cause of the problem. As security expert Bruce Schneider points out, the true causes of government cyber insecurity include insufficient access controls, lack of encryption, poor network management, failure to install patches, inadequate audit procedures, and incomplete or ineffective information security programs. The Cybersecurity Act does nothing to address these basic computer hygiene issues and instead poses a serious threat to our personal freedom and privacy. So you know the drill. Do your own research, then call and email your reps, urging them to oppose this bill and start standing up for our freedom. It's up to us to protect our rapidly eroding freedoms, so please share this video with your friends and help spread the word. That's it for now. I'm Shelley Roach. Thanks for watching and thanks for your support.
Okay, that was a short piece from the absolutely gorgeous, I have to say, Shelley Roach, who is the CTO of this organization. And, you know, they've really embraced a really excellent marketing approach here. You know, it's young people, intelligent, good looking. I mean, they're doing some good stuff here, okay?
They're using the mainstream style.
They are, and
of,
yet they
MTV style, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and it's we need to see that, you know. I mean, we don't need to be kind of like, you know, dressed in grey flannel. You know, we don't need to be like Mao Zedong. You know, you don't need to be. you know what I mean? Like, there's that image of the kind of the revolutionary, you know, dressed in grey, looking glum, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't even consider myself a revolutionary or anything.
Well, I consider you a revolutionary. You know? So whether you like it or not, you've been labelled and blacklisted.
Pigeonholed.
No, you've been whitelisted. You've been whitelisted. Okay.
Well, look, I
know you don't want to admit it. Like a lot of freedom-loving people don't want to admit that they're revolutionaries. You know, and it's understandable. But the point is, revolution, you know, has got a bad name. Okay. But remember what Kennedy said. Kennedy said, if you don't make peaceful revolution possible, you will make violent revolution inevitable.
Yeah.
So it's our job to make peaceful revolution possible.
Mm.
That's the way I see it. I do firmly believe that peaceful revolution is the real revolution, whereas the violent revolution tends to be the failed revolutions.
Well, that's right. The violent revolutions, all they do is install new and usually worse dictators.
Correct. Yeah.
And usually what happens is the military then take over the whole thing, which is then a total martial law state, which is totally what we're all against, you know. So it is totally, totally, totally important, folks, to never become violent, ever. Of course, if they're, you know, coming in and taking your kids and marching you off to a camp, then, you know, do whatever you can. But
yeah, if they, you know, if the jackboot's coming through the door, or the, you know, they want to rape your, you know, your family, I think then the time comes that you do have to do things that are going to be hard and unpleasant. And there are issues of self protection and self defense. I don't say, you know, never be violent. I just think It's proportional. You have to understand what the threat is and deal with it proportionally. That's the way I'd say it.
Yeah, yeah. Look, the most important thing right now is to educate. I mean, people need to be educated, because when people are educated, they don't stand for stuff. And we've still got enough freedoms, folks, to turn this around. We've still got enough freedoms to make this peaceful. We've still got enough freedoms to just say, hang on, I'm turning off the telly tonight. I'm turning it off, and I'm going to, go and tell other people about why the government having access to every part of your life isn't a good thing. You know, I mean, governments are the biggest killers in the world. You know, more people have died from government than any other thing in the world. Any other thing by far, by so much further than anything else, than smoking and all of that put together. So it's really important to really realize that governments are usually power-hungry freaks that just want to gain more and more power. That's who's attracted to government. People that are attracted to government, there's some good people as well. There's the rare good person that wants to go in there to do the right thing, but more often than not, it's the bullies and the power hungry and the elite and the money hungry that usually go up there, and they feel comfortable in the corridors of power. They're the ones that end up wanting more power, building more and more of infrastructure around them and taking more of your freedoms, because that's what they feel good about.
So true. We've kind of used up our time tonight. We're going to have to wind up the show.
Great show again. Loved the interview.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Stay tuned. We're going to be every week I want to get someone interesting on to interview. That's my goal. I might not always succeed, but you know, we've always got, you know, Josh here to fall back on if we don't have someone to speak to, and
fallback guy.
I say that, you know, with great
I think this show is really going places, and
thank
folks,
you.
get onto the site, get onto truthnews.com.au, become part of it. You know, start telling your friends about the show, tell your family about the show, tell your colleagues, and become, you know, start commenting. And also, yeah, you know, if you we're going to start putting up little banners that you can stick around on your websites and stuff. We've got some of them. I think we've got one banner available. Like,
we have some banners, yes. I think we might actually make our banner, our Truth News banner, available so people can stick it up on their own page. That'd be great,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, become part of it and really spread the message of freedom, folks. It's so important at this time when they're slowly eroding. It's really, really important.
It is. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you, Australia. Thank you, planet Earth. It's over and out from us guys here at Truth News Radio Australia.